brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and Straight Talk with the Guys in the Community.
Prep Radio, on time, on target. On with us for the first time is the author of Blindsided by the Taliban, a journalist's story of war, trauma, love, and loss, which is out on Skyhorse Publishing, and that is Carmen Gentile. Am I saying that right, by the way, Carmen Gentile?
That's exactly how I say it, Gentile.
Perfect. You know, whose right eye was shattered and went blind while embedded with the Army in 2010 as a journalist. Thanks for coming on with us. And I think the first thing to get into before we get into the story of that day in September on 2010 would just be your history as a journalist and how you wound up there in the first place.
I never really had a clearly calculated course for my career. I started out reporting in the late 90s. I was living in Cairo. I had studied Arabic in college and had really nothing going on in my life other than bartending. And a professor had said to me, my Arabic professor said, "Why don't you go to Cairo and study more Arabic?" And I thought, sure, why not? I'll do that. So I went there in 98 and really liked being in Egypt and found a job at an English language weekly newspaper. And it just sort of steamrolled from there. Spent 2 years in Egypt. Then I moved on to Washington, D.C., worked there for a couple years before moving on to Brazil, where I lived for 4 years. And then while I was there, started going to Afghanistan, started going to Iraq, and just became a habit of sorts.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about, you know, your experience in the profession of journalism, because it's kind of an important subject or topical now more than ever, I think. You know, a lot of journalists are being demonized, some probably rightly so, but a lot, you know wrongly. You know, journalism plays an important role in our society. It's important to keep the public informed. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about actually working in that profession, since most of our guests are military, they're on the other side of this thing. If you could talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts and what it's really like to work as a journalist, because I think a lot of people, they just don't know, they don't get it. And they think that because they don't know, they project and think that, you know, we're just constantly being lied to by creepy journalists.
You know, what's funny, I'm actually working with a military veteran on a project now, a podcast series called Truth About War. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because we have a similar mentality as it pertains to veterans and active duty as it does with journalists. And he likes to assert that, you know, in any one company, there's going to be a percentage of guys who are just pieces of shit.
Yeah.
So the same goes for my profession. I like to, especially in these trying times where people are look at the media as a monolith and say that that the media is bad. Yeah. And the media is this, that, and whatever. I know bad journalists, you know, just like there are bad doctors and bad lawyers and bad Uber drivers and bad everything. Right. But, you know, when it comes to the folks that I know and I like, and the ones that I am proud to call colleagues that cover conflict, like, you have to understand, it's not a great paying gig, and it's a job where you're risking your neck in a war zone without a weapon. I can't tell you how many times I've gone out on embeds and I've got some young kid standing next to me. He's like, "I can't believe you're out here without a weapon." I'm like, you know, obviously I wouldn't carry a weapon. That's not what we do. But, you know, it never occurred to me that I would be of any use with a weapon. My weapon are my eyes and my notebook and my video camera telling the stories of what's going on here. I'm there to combat misconceptions and shed some light on what the hell's going on. You know, that's what I do. And so I can't speak to why other people do it or what their motivations are. But for me, it's about knowing for myself what's going on in a particular situation. I never, for example, in a place like Afghanistan, I would never say I know what's going on in Afghanistan. Never, ever. In fact, I remember years ago, this is right before Jim Foley was abducted in Syria. He and I were in New York together, and we were out with a bunch of colleagues, and Jim yells from across the room. He's like, "Carmen, do you know what's going on in Afghanistan?" And I look back at him, I go, "Absolutely not. I have no idea." And I've been going there for years, and I would never say that I do. But when I go to a certain place, I go to one combat outpost and I hang out with one group of guys, and I'm there to tell their story through, you know, that tiny little keyhole, trying to see what it is that they're going through there, and to let people know at home what the situation is, and try to create some bigger context for the conflict at large. But I always, as a journalist, go in with the idea that I have no idea what's going on, and that I'm only there to try to figure out a little bit and add to my knowledge. But I've always maintained that the more I learn, the more I learn about the things I don't know.
Yeah.
So that's the attitude I keep, that keeps me doing what I do, I think.
Yeah, I think
my own ignorance.
I think people would be pretty shocked if they learned how much money freelancers make, or rather don't make.
Yeah.
Some of these young journalists, I've known, you know, young women going over to some very dangerous parts of the world to get a picture, to take pictures of conflict, or to write a wire story. And I mean, if they get a couple $100, they're lucky.
Yep. Yeah. A lot of people are going over there on their own dime, their own time, their own steam. And I've lost money on stories plenty of times. You know, I started out my career doing that. I try not to do it now, obviously. I'm a little bit older and a little more established. But, you know, the costs, you're not going to get rich doing this job. This is a gig that pays you in Hershey Kisses and buttons if you're lucky, you know?
Yeah, I think the only people who make good money are, like, you know, the Bob Rosses, you know, those types of people who are like the figureheads of major three-letter networks.
Yeah, they make good money. But, you know, I've been fortunate that I've been able to do it long enough that I've been able to, you know, do a little bit better as I've gone on. But no, I'm not flush with cash, that's for sure.
Yeah, I know. I get a kick out of it too when you know, you publish a story people don't like, and like, "Jack Murphy, you're just doing this to make money, you money grubbing fool." It's like, dude, you think publishing little stories that people hate me for makes me rich? Like, you can't. let me bring you back down to reality.
Yeah, absolutely.
If anything, you're costing your company money when you do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an odd dynamic. And, you know, I definitely believe, you know, in accountability, and, you know, there should be accountability for bad journalism. But at the same time, it's like this whole scale demonization, you know, as you say, the quote unquote, in air quotes, the media.
Yeah. What's the media? I don't even know what the media is. You know, are you going to say that, you know, first of all, if you're saying media, I assume people mean the news media, because media at large would be your show, reruns of Seinfeld, you know, that's all media. Like, so don't, okay, just say the news. All right. You want to say fake news? I can't stop people from saying that stuff. And I don't, I find it bothersome, but all I can do to combat it is do my job and keep doing it right, and hopefully tell stories that people find compelling and shed some light on some shadowy situations. That's it.
It is true that it's not specific, though, because I think when some people say fake news, they're thinking of like network news. Sometimes they're thinking of opinion shows. If they're on the left, they're thinking of Sean Hannity. If they're on the right, they're thinking of Rachel Maddow. And like, that's right. A very small microcosm of the media or the news media at large.
Right. I mean,
right.
Go ahead, Carmen.
Well, I think it's funny. People ask me, they'll say to me, you know, what news do you follow? But they're not what they really are saying. What do you watch? And I'm thinking, if you're asking me what to watch, then I'm not going to be able to give you any idea of what's worthwhile in terms of being informed. You're not going to get informed watching CNN have talking heads go on and on about the same issue that's all day. You know what? You're just the same way. You're not going to become a world-class athlete watching ESPN debate the same issue all over a day, you know, all day, every day. It doesn't, it's ridiculous. Politics have become sports.
Yeah, I agree.
And news and whatever side you're on, if you're, you know, find yourself on the left, the right, wherever, it's, you're just picking up teams. I'm surprised we don't have fantasy leagues for Capitol Hill now.
Yeah, I think they've found with like the popularity of those shows like Crossfire and Hannity and Combs and how well they do in the ratings. It's like before we even inform you on an issue, we're going to have the split screen debate. Before you even know what to think, they want the public to say, I'm on the right or the left of this issue. But they don't even know what they're debating. And that's a huge problem, I think, that people are uninformed and they want to take a side. They want to be on.
They want that passion.
Yeah.
Yeah, but everybody wants to have that. It's that reaffirming what you already think.
Yeah.
And what's the point of that? You know, when people really ask me, how do I stay informed? I'll tell them to read the most vanilla down the middle news they can. I'm like, look, just read the wires and then try to get an idea for yourself of what is going on in a particular place or a particular time. It's funny. I'll have people come up to me and also say, you know what? I never hear anything about Afghanistan. I never see it in the news anymore. And I'm thinking to myself, I got a Google News alert set up for Afghanistan. There are 200 stories coming out of that country every day. It's just, there's, you know, this whole idea of it's not in the paper or it's not on the front page. I'm like, what's the front page? There's no front page anymore. The front page is what you decide.
True.
What goes into your on your Facebook page and what goes into your Twitter, whatever is it, your front page is, I don't mean to get all metaphysical, but it's like whatever's inside you that interests you. That's your front page, you know?
Before we get into, you know, doing combat reporting on the ground and in beds and all that, what were you doing? But what kind of stories did you cover before all of that? What was your experience like?
Well, you know, before I started covering the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, I had my first experience covering conflict was in Haiti during the coup in 2004.
Oh, really?
And man, to this day, that is some of the worst stuff I've ever seen.
Really?
They were just, you know, they're dropping bodies everywhere and, you know, with signs of torture or just mutilation. It was terrible. And, you know, like, there were children riding around on BMX bikes with AKs in the handlebars, you know, it was madness. That was my first introduction into the deepest recesses of just how awful humanity could be. And, from there, it was shortly thereafter that I started going to, Afghanistan and Iraq. But prior to that, I was based in, Sao Paulo and then in Rio de Janeiro. And I was primarily doing Latin America stuff. I found a real passion for that region and stories there I found compelling, particularly at a time when this is the beginning of the global war on terror and people weren't paying close enough attention to that. They weren't paying attention to anything else except for what was going on in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I kind of carved out my little space there doing those stories. Until I can no longer resist the siren song of covering those conflicts.
I'd say that's still true today as far as reporting. Absolutely. From a national security standpoint. We don't hear enough about Latin America.
No, and it's always the promise. I remember that was George Bush's big promise before September 11 in even in his campaign that the U.S. was going to pay closer attention to what was going on in Latin America. In fact, his first foreign trip shortly after he was elected was he went to Mexico. Mm-hmm. And there was this great hope in the region that finally there was going to be somebody who was paying attention to what was going on in the hemisphere. And that changed real quick after September 11. Yeah. So Maybe someday.
Then what got you into doing combat embeds? Was that something that your newspaper pushed you into, or were you interested in doing
I just, you know, it was one of those things where maybe if I'd given it more thought, I never would have done it. But I never, a lot of forethought is not my forte. And I just got it in my head that I would give it a try because other people I'd known and respected had done it, and they told me how to do it. And I remember the first real embed I had was in Iraq in 2005, and I was in northern Iraq in Kirkuk, and that situation wasn't too bad at that time. And then we went a little further west into some other smaller towns, and it was the Wild West. It was really bad. There was a lot of we were getting shot at all the time. In fact, the first time I had ever had an RPG fired in my direction, I was in a convoy of Humvees. This goes to show you how far back it was. We were in Humvees, and I was in the lead Humvee with the CO, and a guy from down this narrow road pops out, fires off an RPG. The thing skips right in front of the truck and bounces to the side, and then explodes. And all of a sudden, you hear the gunner go, "Yeehaw!" They're bolting down the side of this road, this narrow ass road, and there's cars parked on both sides, and the Humvee's barreling through, and the cars are going up on their sides, like off their axles, and they're chasing this guy down. And we turned a corner, and we saw this vehicle with all four doors open. And these guys jump out of the truck, and I'm like, "That thing's got to be booby trapped. This is my first embed." I'm like, "I know that can't be right." So these guys jump out of the truck and go up to the vehicle. They find the launcher, a Russian sniper rifle, and a video camera. And then we took the video camera and the vehicle back to the cop, and we play the video on the camera. And it was a video of the attack. It was back in the day. Yeah, you know, this is like pre YouTube, but they were using it in their propaganda videos. You know. So you saw our vehicle, and you saw the trail of smoke and the ordnance.
That's pretty gnarly.
Yeah, it was. So that was my first real close call.
For people who like really don't understand, like, could you talk a little bit about how that process works? Like, how do you become an embedded journalist with the military?
You know, the military in these wars had a very a very well organized system whereby mm-hmm. you would apply to, you know, you go to the, you know, you find out who the embed coordinator is. You go to that, you send your email with a request. I want to go to this place and I want to cover this aspect of what's going on there. And then they would, you know, go through your application and they would either approve it or not. Usually I never had one that wasn't approved. And, you would get linked up. Let's say if you were in Afghanistan, you'd probably go to someplace like Bagram first from Kabul. You get a car to Bagram, go to the gate. They let you in with your ID, and then they get you set up where they move you anywhere, points east or south or wherever you're going. It's funny because journalists are the lowest priority for moving personnel around in a war zone, and as well they should be. It was a friend of mine once, a fellow journalist, told me that he'd once got bumped off a flight heading into Jalalabad because there was a barista for the green bean coffee place that needed to get back to Jalalabad. And they're like, "Who do we take? The journalist or the guy that makes the coffee?" You know, the guy that is getting that seat every time. So yeah, being a bump for a barista, which I get, man. You know, that's a priority. But yeah, so sometimes the movement is slow, but you get around. You know, I have been all over Afghanistan on military transport in places I would not have been able to go, had it not been, for hitching a ride with them. And, you know, and that goes for, convoys and on foot patrols as well. You know, I'm not going to go wandering into remote parts of Eastern Afghanistan on my own. Never make it, you know, a tenth of the way there without getting my head lopped off.
And so your first embed for Afghanistan, was that the Kunar deployment?
No, I'd been going there for years and years earlier. I'd been going. The first time I went to Afghanistan in 05, I actually didn't do any embeds. I was doing some work in and around Kabul and travel. I went down to Kandahar without an embed. Mm-hmm. But it was a different time. The security situation was better, and you could actually – I remember walking the streets of Kandahar. I was dressed in traditional local clothes, but I kept a low profile and I could do it. But no, I started doing a lot of embeds in Afghanistan in 2009 when the Obama surge started to kick up. And that's when I started doing it a lot there. And at that period, I was doing a lot of in southern Afghanistan, in Kandahar, and then in Kunar. And it wasn't until 2010, that's when I got hurt. Yeah.
That was a really hot area in 2010, wasn't it?
Oof, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's everything I hear from 2010, when I got hurt, and then I went back to that same area in 2011, it was still hot. And then 2012, I went back to the exact same combat outpost where I'd gotten hurt, and the situation had deteriorated even more. You know, now that's all Taliban.
Yeah.
And ISIS territory.
I was just having drinks last night with a friend of mine from college, actually, but he was military intelligence, and he was in Kunar around that same time frame, and just telling me some stories about it and the terrain and how difficult it was to work over there.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really difficult, really steep mountains, high elevation, brutally hot in the summer, bitterly cold in the winter. All the combat outposts were for some reason at the bottom of these valleys where you're surrounded by mountains on 360 degrees. No one's ever been able to adequately explain to me, how anyone could justify that from a tactical standpoint. Greater military minds than I might have a reason, but no one's ever been able to give it to me. It doesn't seem to make any sense to me. And you ask any soldier or serviceman why that is the case, and they don't have an answer either. So I'm waiting for some general to tell me.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were cases in Vietnam, too, where like the FOB placement as far as where they were put was just tactically unsound. Guys were getting bombarded.
Constantly. That's the story of anybody's ever seen Restrepo. That's it. You know, how do you justify that? I have no idea. Is it just because he can't put it on the top of a mountain at, 11,000 feet? Okay. Then what's it doing? What good are you at the bottom? Are you just there to draw fire? That's what it seemed like.
So can you tell us about the unit you embedded with then at that point? And what was it like integrating with these young Joes? And, you of course, being a member of the liberal media coming in.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was
like?
Funny. I remember at that time I was, how old was I? I was 36.
Yeah, because you remember there's that line in the book where the guy says, "Oh, you're 2 years younger than my dad."
Yeah, exactly. This guy's a young punk, is 19 years old. He's like, "Yeah, it's amazing you can hang with us." And I was dragging ass, of course. But like, you know what? Politics never comes up.
I understand.
Nobody ever brings that stuff up because
it doesn't matter.
It's irrelevant. Yeah. It's completely irrelevant. You know, those guys are all out there to get each other's backs and to make sure that they can come home. And I'm out there not to tell their story and not get in their way and do anything that's going to jeopardize their chances of going home. That's it. You know, and so funny enough, I'd say 90% of the time we talk about sports and what's been on TV since they've been gone. That's it. That's what, it's never really been an issue about matters in Washington because it's irrelevant. Like, like why they're there. I would never discuss that really with a young soldier for a couple reasons. Just like I said, there's the irrelevancy. And the fact of the matter is, even if these guys would spout off to me about, whatever their political leanings are, some sergeant major is going to eat their ass out for it if it ends up in one of my stories. And I know that, like, what's the point of me getting some, 18-year-old private in trouble for some shit like that? I don't want to ruin this kid's life,
Yeah,
that's the way I look at it.
Well, I mean, like you say, I mean, the guys on the ground are dealing with this very pragmatic situation and this high level politics, policy decisions being made thousands of miles away. Just like no one gives a shit about that.
No, and also if you're, and I don't mean to disparage the young, but I remember at 19, I didn't know what the hell was going on in the world. So why, just because they're in this corner of Afghanistan, you know, fighting this fight, like, does that mean that they have a better idea of the geopolitical, you know, machinations and how they may or may not be perceived as pawns in this great game? Like, no, man. Why would they know that stuff?
Well, what did you notice though from those young men? I mean, were any of them like well read, or did they what I'm getting at is, did they understand where they were? Did they understand the cultural environment they were in? Because I mean, going from being a 19-year-old living in America with the land of hamburgers and French fries, I mean, that's a super culture shock going to a place like Kunar.
Yeah. These guys, when they prepare for a deployment, I know that they are tasked with learning things about the culture. I know that they have training sessions, even that go as far as, you know, what it's like to sit down with a village elder. I know they have these, you know, like practice sessions for what it's like for where they're going to be. And that's part of their training, their ramp up to deployment. I can't speak to it specifically, but I think it's like a year's worth of this training as to, you know, what the situation there, where they're going to be, what the kind of challenges they're going to be facing, what the locals are like. And they have like actors come in and do all this stuff that teach them how to do these things. So, you know, they're well prepared. It's not, I don't think it's, you know, like in Vietnam where you got 8 weeks of basic and then they shipped you off to the jungle, you know?
Yeah. By 2010, I mean, I think on a lot of the bases, they were building up like, mock towns, that mimicked Afghan villages. And as you said, they'd have role players and things like that.
Which is which is a lot more preparation, I think, they were getting when they went into Vietnam.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
So, you know, and there's a difference in that, you know, if we're comparing it to Vietnam as well, is that this is an all volunteer force. Mm-hmm. These are people that actually want to be there. When it's getting time for deployment and they're picking who's going to go and who's going to stay. I mean, these guys want to go. You know, men and women want to be there.
What unit was this, by the way?
What's that?
What unit was this you were with, by the way?
I was with the 101st.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, which is the most deployed of both the Iraq and Afghan wars. These guys and men and women, I can't even tell you how many times they've been everywhere. In fact, it was funny. Years later, 2010 is when I got hurt, and in the story, I'm injured alongside a young lieutenant named Derek Zotto. And then in 2013, he gets redeployed back to Afghanistan, and I link up with him, and we went and did another embed together in eastern Afghanistan.
Oh, wow.
And it was funny because he was a captain at that time, and he had a fairly uneventful deployment, and they were getting ready to leave in like less than a month. So we're out on this mission. He and I are standing on this road in a remote part of eastern Afghanistan in Nangarhar, a place called Achin District, which is now the de facto headquarters for ISIS in Afghanistan. He and I were standing on the road. He'd spent 9 months in country where nothing much had happened. And just down the road, a rocket hits the ground and just blows up, you know, like 100 yards down the road and like blows our hair back, and we go scurrying to the trucks. He's like, I can't believe the first time I go out with you and I almost get killed again.
You're a missile magnet.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so, can you tell us a little bit about that day when you got hurt? Because I mean, you actually got hit by an RPG.
That's correct. We were on a foot patrol in a remote village in eastern Afghanistan, a few kilometers from the Pakistani border. And we were walking through this, I call it a village, just a collection of stone mud homes. And you can hear the sound of rockets from the next village. There was an engagement with another unit over there. And it's funny enough, we were making jokes. I was shooting video at the time, and I was making jokes, and the guys were making jokes because there's marijuana growing everywhere. And so when we were walking through the village, we got immediately the vibe got really chilly. It was the last day of Ramadan and it was near sunset, and the locals were preparing for their Eid feast. And here we are rolling through, you know, up armored vehicles and dismounted on a patrol. In retrospect, this was a terrible idea, but there we were. And I stopped to talk to a group of young men sitting on the side of the road. And I had already had a hinky feeling about what was going on, because as some of your listeners will identify with this, is that there were no children around. Usually when you go into a village and the children around, it's okay. But when the children scatter, you know something's you know something's going on, right? No kids around. Everybody's giving us the stink eye. And I'm talking to these guys on camera, and I'm barely able to understand through the interpreter what they're saying, because I just know there's something wrong. And so I hear this whooshing sound, and I see these guys, their eyes get really big, and I turn around, and about 40 yards down the road, there's a guy shouldering his RPG launcher and fired the ordnance, and it was screaming right at me. I mean, the tip was coming right at me, and I could see the trail of smoke behind it, and then it just clocked me in the side of the face.
What the fuck?
Smacked me straight up in the side of the head, didn't detonate, and it hit the lieutenant Zotto in the elbow and then clattered to the ground.
Holy shit.
Immediately, as soon as it hit me in the side of the head, my right eye went black.
Mm-hmm.
And I just heard this. It was a concussion in my head. I mean, not only did I have a concussion, but it was reverberating in my head like a gong. And I went down to one knee, and I immediately put my hand over my eye, and I just blood was pouring out. And I figured, oh man, that just blew my eye out of my head. I thought that, you know, my eye had popped out, and I just couldn't believe that I was still alive at first, because when it came at me, I saw the thing and I was frozen by panic. And then just in those few moments, I had that resignation, like, oh fuck, I'm done. This is it. I'm lights out. And when it hit me, I figured, okay, this is me, you know, going into the void. And I realized a few moments later, oh wait, I'm still alive.
Holy shit.
How is this possible? And you can, if you see the video that's on YouTube, you hear somebody ask, are you okay? And my only response is, no, obviously I just got shot in the head. You know? Everybody was just shocked. Nobody could, it wasn't even anybody screaming. They're like, holy, like, how did that just happen? And then finally, everyone snapped out of it, and you could hear somebody on the radio going, RPG, RPG. And they pulled me to the side of the road. And my camera is still running, and so but you can't see me. And so people are treating me, and you can hear me asking the medic, hey, do I still have my eye? And he kept telling me, yeah, you do. You still have it. And I thought, this guy's bullshitting me. My eyes. Somebody go to the other side of the road and pick up my eye if it's still there. Not that they're going to be able to do anything with it. And so I kept asking him, and finally he said, yeah, it's fine. I can still see it. It's baby blue. And I'm like, it's a nice thing to say, young man. So they put me in one of the trucks, and they took me just a little bit down the road so that so they can get an evac in, and helicopter came in and picked myself and Lieutenant Zotto up. And off I was to Bagram, where I had my first surgery by a very nice military ophthalmologist who just happened to be there to fix and save and ultimately save the eye that I thought I was going to, I had already lost.
And of course, had that RPG gone off, okay. So I'm going back into the vernacular. It would have been a PG-7 anti-tank or rocket, I believe.
Yeah.
If it had it gone off, both of you guys would have been done, of course.
No, they would have sent me home in a matchbox. There would have been nothing left. Maybe a couple teeth.
And
that's it.
I would speculate that one of two things happened. Either the guy who shot it left a safety cap over the front of the fuse, or when that rocket hit you, it may have knocked the fuse loose, because it has piezoelectric crystals in it. So when they get crushed, the rocket explodes. It detonates the actual warhead. So it may have knocked that loose when it hit you. But at any rate, I mean, that's pretty fucking amazing.
It may not have had enough distance to even arm, too, because those things are designed not to go off at a certain distance, so that if you're firing at something that's close, I mean, it was so close. I could practically see the white of the guy's eyes.
It really?
He was right down the road. So I don't know. I'll never know. And I, you know, my assertion is that I'm alive by a trillion to one shot. You know, I have a better chance of winning the Powerball twice than to having what happened to me happen.
And so you got evacuated to Bagram. And then what was it like trying to recover from this? Was that a pretty long, hard road? Or
yeah, it was made more difficult by my own repeated acts of jackassery.
By the way, all this is documented in the book, I should point
right,
out, which is
right. I don't want to give away Taliban, too much but. of the goods, but I had a long haul. It took me 8 months and a total of 4 surgeries. I wasn't hospitalized the whole time. In fact, most of the time I was out. There was a period during which after my first 3 major surgeries, I had to spend a month, basically keeping my head down because I had a surgery on my retina for reattachment and they had this special lens they were going to put in my eye so I had to keep my head down all the time. So, I had this special massage chair where I kept my head in a hole and I had to sleep with face down with my head down all the time. So that's not really good for your spirits or your neck.
Yeah.
So that was a real bummer. And I was living in New York just to be, close to the hospital where they were treating me. So I had this apartment in Washington Heights that I was put up in, and I was mostly just wallowing in my own pity. And I had a series of personal setbacks at the time as well that I'll let readers get into.
Yeah, that's in the book as well with your fiance at the time. So
yeah, there was a whole situation with that in which I was engaged to someone at the time, and everything just went sideways and. I don't want to spoil too much of it, but yeah, it took me a long time to, to recover. And then I felt that once I was cleared to work, and that was in May of 2011, my doctor said, okay, you're allowed to go back to work. And what they meant by go back to work was, be a reporter. You want to go sit at a desk somewhere or whatever. And I said, well, no, I'm going to go back to Afghanistan. And they, thought, wow, this guy's, I don't know why we even fixed him if he's going to just go do that. I mean, what do we do? All this guy's going to screw up all my beautiful handiwork. Yeah, I went back. As soon as I was cleared to go back in May 1st, 2011, 2 weeks later, I was back in Afghanistan.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
Before we get into, going back, I'm kind of curious, what was your family's reaction? Because I think when someone joins the military, their family is preparing for possibly the worst. When you become a journalist, even, a war correspondent and all that type of stuff, I don't think the reality would set in because, let's be honest, someone like Anderson Cooper has been in, crazy war zones, but what happened to you doesn't happen to those guys.
No. that was torture for my folks. Absolutely. And, then me saying I'm going to go back, they didn't say don't do it, but they knew that I had to go, I didn't want what happened to me. I dictate the rest of my life.
Yeah.
I'm well aware of the fact that when I die, somewhere in the first or second paragraph, there's going to be mention of the fact that I got shot in the head with an RPG. But I'd like to think that it could go beyond that in some capacity. So I just didn't want that to be the sole definer of who I am. And I thought the only way I could get past it is if I just got past it and got back on the horse. So I ended up going back, and boy, I was scared to death. I was so scared. As soon as the plane touched down in Kabul, when I first went back, I remember the wheels touching down. I'm thinking, holy Christ, what a huge mistake this is. I got to get the fuck out of here immediately. I was just pouring sweat. Like, this is, what the hell am I doing? There's no sense to any of this. And I ended up staying on that trip, one of the longest periods I've ever been in the country consistently. I was there for 4 months and I was hopping around from embed to embed. I went back to Kunar. I went all over the place and just, I found my, I didn't find peace, but I found that I just, knew that this is something I'm one of the few things at which I'm pretty good at doing. So I felt good to be able to do it again. You know?
When did that fear go away, if ever?
Never. Never. I mean, never. I was in Iraq covering the effort to retake Mosul, and I was embedded with Iraqi special forces. This is in the height of the effort to take it back in like March of 2017. And it was some of the worst fighting I've ever seen, you know, just bodies everywhere, house to house, block to block. People who had been living under ISIS siege for months, for years, and were streaming out, carrying whatever they could. And I was just scared to death the whole time. It was terrible. There were explosions that would just shake the ground beneath you. And I remember at one point we were on top of this like 6-story apartment building, just to get a better vantage of what was going on in the next block to see what the fighting was. And I look around and there's all this black asphalt on the roof. And it was from the explosions that blown it up 6 stories and it was landing on rooftops. That's how it was, just insane. But yeah, I was scared to death that whole time. I mean, I don't think being scared is a bad thing. Being scared is a good thing. Because if you're not scared, you're not taking the right precautions. Like, I know people that cover conflict that seem to just, and I don't want to speak to anyone specifically or even in general, but it just seems like there are some people that have no fear. And having no fear is not the same thing as being brave. Being brave is, in my estimation, is like, okay, I'm afraid, but I'm gonna work through that fear in a way that is productive, and I'm gonna take what I consider to be calculated risks. People who don't take calculated risks, who take stupid risks, I don't think that they're brave. I think they're either crazy or they're trying to get killed.
Yeah,
maybe that's the same thing.
That's kind of as referring to a little bit earlier about the freelancers who don't make any money. And I mean, on one hand, I respect what they're trying to accomplish. But on the other hand, it's like, damn, girl, do you really need to go do that? Like, you're probably going to die if you go there and do that. So I kind of have mixed feelings.
I have young freelancers ask me questions all the time about, you know, who want to do what I do. And they'll say, how do you do, you know, can you give me advice? And I say, no. Not at all. I'm not going to. And it's not because I don't want them to do it per se, but if they get killed and after I tell them to do something, or after they just spoke to me about it, that's going to be on me. I'm going to carry that around like an anvil for the rest of my life. So maybe I'm being selfish in that sense, but I can't go out of my way and to recommend anybody do that kind of work. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But I had a friend of mine who went through that, where a young person asked him for advice and he gave it to him, and then that person ended up dying. And now, wow, you know, he carries that around with him. I can't do that.
It's you and I get the sense we've crisscrossed each other, going to some of the same places, but maybe all kind of at the same time, actually. But, I was wondering if you have taken any from seeing these different conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq at different times, and seeing, you know, getting that perspective. I just wondered if you have drawn any conclusions about modern warfare and the modern way of fighting or not fighting. I guess just where I'm going with this, if there's any like big picture conclusions that you've drawn from warfare in the 21st century.
You know, there was just a good piece in the what's the West Point military
CTC,
like modern warfare. Anyway, they just did a piece about this, about the preparation for the next generations of wars. I think that and again, I am not an expert. Just because I spend a lot of time around the military doesn't mean I know what the hell I'm talking about. But I think that the U.S. had a conventional force that was fighting an unconventional war. And I think that the military is still struggling to figure out how to fight unconventional warfare. We haven't fought a true uniform-on-uniform war since World War II. Like, how do you fight in a regular – like – everyone in Afghanistan is a friendly and a foe. You don't know who's who. Same for Iraq, and same in all these wars now. It'd be really nice if ISIS would wear uniforms. I'd really appreciate that. So we could see who's a good guy and who's a bad guy. But that's just not the case. And I don't know how to prepare to fight that kind of enemy unless everyone receives, special operation force training. Can we make the whole conventional military just be soft? Would that be possible? Can we just have, instead of having, just a select number of high operator, high speed individuals, that would be the only way to do it, I think. If they were all high speed, high functioning, high operators, I know that's not possible, but that's probably the only way to do it, right? Like, how do you do it? I have no idea.
I think Special Operations Forces has not done such a great job with unconventional warfare. I mean, what they've done is really perfected the direct action counterterrorism aspects of their mission. But I think I think we've kind of failed to deliver on the unconventional warfare aspect of it. And I would make the point, I think this is interesting, that from an American perspective, we would think, well, okay, we need to take our soldiers and give them some sort of unconventional warfare training, increase their schooling and so forth. But the enemies we're fighting, be it ISIS or the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or whoever, they have pretty minimal training.
Yeah.
And it's like they just go and do it.
Well,
so it's a cultural issue.
Here's the thing, and I call this the Kaiser Soze principle. And what do I mean by that? In the movie The Usual Suspects, when they're telling the story of how Kaiser Soze came to be, the story goes that Kaiser Soze realized you don't need guns or money or numbers. You just need to have the will to do what other people won't. And ISIS has the will to do things that other people won't. Yeah. And the thing is, I say U.S. forces, NATO forces, can't get in the mud and do the same things. Because I know this is probably some people will construe this as naive thinking, but I have spent enough time downrange to have given this enough thought. You have to maintain some semblance of, I hate using this word, righteousness. Like, you can't, you know what I mean? Like, let's go back to when the Soviets were fighting in Afghanistan in the 80s, and they were dropping toy bombs for kids to pick up because they knew that it would blow off their arms and that would take their parents out of the fight. We can't do that. We just can't. We can't. And I can't give you a reason that is going to convince everyone. I'm just going to say you can't do it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that they're willing to do. ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, whatever extremist group or militants you're fighting, that's how they are able to compete. And they also compete because there was a story done years ago where they were comparing the amount it costs to send one U.S. soldier, to keep one U.S. soldier in theater for a year as opposed to one Taliban soldier. And for a U.S. soldier, it's like $1 million a year. But for a Taliban fighter, it's about $250 a year.
Yeah.
And, these guys are running around in the mountains in flip-flops and rusty AKs. And all you could throw all the aerial bombardments, JDAMs and whatnot at them, but they know where the caves are.
Yeah, the local knowledge.
You know
how it is
in Afghanistan. You know, they call in an airstrike and they blow the shit out of some hilltop, and you're like, whoa, look at that. They just lit that hill up. And then 10 minutes later, you're looking around, and you're like, I can't even tell where it is they hit. The old saying goes, the problem with blowing stuff up in Afghanistan is it looks exactly the same afterwards as it did beforehand. Like, how do that's a huge challenge. You couldn't carpet bomb the place. You can't carpet bomb your way to victory in Afghanistan. And with these,
we couldn't do it in Vietnam.
And yeah, and you can't do it with, you can't do it in anywhere where you're dealing with an ISIS or other extremist group, because the more extreme you get, the more extreme they get.
Yeah.
So we need to think, when you say, you know, the long way around back to this, to your question is, what do we need to do in terms of to fight these fights in the future? Maybe figure out what it is we can do. And people are going to hate me for this. Like, maybe we got to figure out what we're going to do off the battlefield,
yeah,
to not be in that fight. Like, we got to start thinking about how we interact with the rest of the world.
Sure.
I don't think people will hate you for it. I mean, you, Jack, co-authored the book, The ISIS Solution, and you guys talk about that very thing, about fighting the war on social media and in the media in general. And that, you know, I remember Brandon made the comparison to how smoking cigarettes is relatively uncool in America, and we have to make terrorism uncool over there.
Yeah. I mean, that would involve quite a bit of social engineering, maybe more than we're prepared for. But I mean, I think that the point stands, of course. Yeah. And as long as these, you know, people live in abject poverty in some parts of the world, you know, an insurgency that comes by and promises a better life is going to hold some sort of legitimacy in their eyes. So it's definitely not easy to fight any way you cut it.
It's not easy to fight. And I think that, again, I agree with what you said, but the funny thing is you can say that a lot better than I can in this current climate where as my journalist says that it seems like I'm going soft on
the liberal media. Insurgents,
you know. But you can get away with it better, and I'm glad that you say that. But yeah, there has to be, and I don't think it could go beyond the social media, and it can go beyond you know, finding ways in which to no longer make ISIS and joining these other groups a sexy alternative for people who are, you know, disaffected youth in the U.S. and in Europe to want to go over there and join them. That would take a concerted effort by our leaders across the world to be like, okay, how do we keep young people out of these situations? How do we promote greater social stability at home? How do we, you know, that's a huge, yeah, huge ask. And that would take a great deal of coordination. And that would take a great deal of long-term effort that is hard to sell to people. Whereas going to war is an easier sell.
Yeah, people can understand it. They can wrap their
minds. They can understand it. Right. But when you're saying, like, you know, just let's look at what the you know, President Trump's decision to pull troops out of Syria. Look, I hate seeing more men and women in harm's way. And that situation is you're fighting a multi-front proxy war where you one day you're allied with Turkey and the next day you know Turkey's back in ISIS. Yeah. And they're, you know, I mean, the whole thing is just it's a disaster of epic proportions that I have never been able to adequately explain either in my reporting or even in conversation because I don't fully understand it. But, you know, when I saw what Trump said in his decision he made, I immediately thought of that clip from the end of Charlie Wilson's War where he said, look, we do the same thing every time. We go in and we change the world and then we leave.
Yeah.
But then the great Tom Hanks twanging that he imitates of Charlie Wilson, and he says, you know, but that ball, it keeps on bouncing. And it does, man. That ball keeps on bouncing. And we take off, and what's going to happen now? And in Syria, it's only a matter of time before, you know, Turkey steps in and fights the Kurds, and we leave the Kurds to hang out to dry again.
Turkey, you know, these people will certainly invade if the Assad regime doesn't come back in and occupy that space. I have no doubt the Turks
absolutely, because they have historical claim to it. They want that space, and they want the Kurds out of there, and they will go in. They're the second largest military in NATO. They would love to go fangs out right across the border, and take it to the Kurds. And the Kurds, what have you know? We rely on the Kurds. We relied heavily on the Kurds in the fight against Al Qaeda in Iraq and against ISIS this time around.
Yeah.
All they do is trust trust that the U.S. is going to be there for them, and we keep letting them down.
I think that they're pragmatic enough at this point to realize that, you know, we can't do everything for them, or we're not going to be there all the time.
They don't want us to do everything for them. I these are hardy, self-sustaining people, and they fight.
Yeah.
They fight to the bitter end.
I think they're smart enough to, let's say, get their money's worth out of us. You know, we used them and they used us to, you know, which is fine.
But when I think of the Kurds, I think of the Kurd civilians that I know and people that are friends, and I think, God damn it.
Yeah.
I feel terrible. We're taking it to, you know, we're pulling the football away again.
Yeah. Well, and the real harm from my point of view is what you were referring to is the ball keeps bouncing. Right. Are we going to just have to turn around and come right back? You know, like we pulled out of Iraq. Then we had to go back a few years later because of ISIS. It's like, rather than bouncing back and forth, I'd rather have a sustained engagement where, you know, even if it's very small troop numbers, rather than just pulling up stakes and leaving entirely.
But the fact of the matter is, and this is another good point that was actually made in that film. War in Syria now for 7 years. That's 7 years that a large portion of the population has not been going to school. That's 7 years of ignorance and nothing but violence and mayhem going on around them.
Your family's dead. And
your family is dead. Thing. In order to combat that, and this is a hard truth and a bitter pill to swallow, you can't just go in there and even maintain stability and build schools for 7 years. You have to go in there and maintain stability and build schools for, my estimation, 21 years.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't take 7 years to undo all those wrongs. It would take a generation and a half to undo all those wrongs. And that's the problem with Afghanistan we've gone through. I mean, you've got now, 40 years of people not having adequate education or reliable utilities and access to the outside world in a meaningful way. It breeds fear and ignorance and contempt and resentment. And, you know, to undo that, and this is gonna really piss people off, it would take 100 years to overcome that in order for them to reestablish even what they had during the 60s when people were walking around Kabul in miniskirts and, you know, going to the malt shop.
Yeah, the trauma induced upon the people of Syria is something that's going to endure for the rest of our lifetimes easily.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's
absolutely
no
absolutely.
Question. And putting that state back together is nearly an impossible task. I mean, I know the government's going to try, the Syrian government's going to try, but the real problems haven't even manifested themselves yet because the war isn't over. You know, people have something to focus on. But, I mean, that's absolutely not to be underestimated. And the other thing I wanted to ask you, make sure we get to before we run out of time, is I want to ask you about a chapter of your book. And you mentioned, and I've noticed this as well, that there are a lot of journalists that focus on interviewing the generals. And they want to go and talk to the generals and get the general sound bites. And the problem is that a lot of times the generals just don't have a fucking clue what's going on. I noticed with a lot of journalists, especially the bigger ones, there's this aversion to interviewing the NCOs and the enlisted men and finding out the real deal, what's really going on.
Yeah. Well, I always had to butt heads with my editors about that because they're like, can you get at somebody above a captain into any of your stories? And my answer is why? They don't know what the hell.
Yeah,
going
what
on,
for?
You know, why? Why? What for?
They're good to talk to about policy and things like that, but not tactics.
Right. So, you know, I would find myself having some conversation with a battalion or brigade commander, and I'd throw a token quote in there, but I didn't really give a shit what those guys had to say. But again, I found myself in the proximity of General Petraeus and I knew I had to do it. So I knew my editors wanted it.
And you got to sit next to Mrs. Broadwell taking notes.
Yeah. And at the time, nobody knew who she was, what that situation was, which was funny. I just remember that young major saying to me, oh yeah, she has special access. I totally knew. And I only learned later when that story came out, I had contacted my editors and it was before we knew her name. I contacted my editors and I was like, look, I'm looking at my notebook. I know exactly who that is, you know? But no, I remember I had to spend all day shadowing General Petraeus as he was touring a school that had been closed and reopened. And, you know, there was a big dog and pony show around him. And they had this commander's meeting. And this is in RC South. So we're in Zari district in Kandahar. And I remember we're at Fob Pasab. We sit down. All the commanders came in. Everyone's there kissing the ring. They treat the guy like he's goddamn Elvis. Everyone's like falling all over the dude. And I just never – my first reaction to authority is to just, you know, I'm like, I don't want any part of that. That doesn't really do it for me.
You noted how like his entourage have all this like glazed over look talking about his visionary leadership and all this.
And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is how they talk about the Ayatollah in Iran. Like, this is a thing, you know, they were in awe. And so I remember we're sitting down and everyone's giving their status report from their different, you know, from corners of RC South. And everyone's just giving these glowing reports about how well they're doing and they're doing this and that. And we killed these dudes and captured these people. And I'm not allowed to write about any of this. So I'm just sitting there with my notebook closed and thinking, you know, it's like 2 hours of listening to this shit. And I'm thinking, is this over? I mean, if we're doing this well, can we all go home? Is this over?
Yeah.
Okay, mission accomplished, I guess. Let's get out of here. So then I get my 15 minutes with General Petraeus, and I just proceed to completely botch the entire interview because the guy speaks in these really long, very orchestrated answers. And I remember like I had 15 minutes, and the first answer took like 8 minutes, and it was just, you know, everything I'd heard him say in countless television interviews. And I'm like, oh, God damn it. This guy is, you know, he's got me worked under, and I didn't really give much a shit about the story anyway. So I tried to throw in some other questions, and finally my 15 minutes is up and I'm like, oh God, this is terrible. So I got to go write up this shitty story.
One of the things I did like about that, that movie War Machine, which is a parody of, you know, General McChrystal, it really brings forward the homoerotica of the general's staff. there's a lot of truth to that.
Oh, absolutely. It's hysterical. Those guys, they could not get enough of the guy. And this is right before he was about to make his move into the CIA director position.
I have an Uncle Dave story also, and I don't know if I ever told this, but I was a helper for Columbia University when I was going to school on Veterans Day, escorting a Medal of Honor recipient around from World War II. He slew like 12 Nazis in the Battle of the Bulge. Wow. Like, he's a fucking badass dude. Yeah. But anyway, Dave Petraeus was there. He was the director of the CIA at the time. And I just remember it because I was he got separated from his own security detachment, his CIA people. And they were like way at the end of the parade, and Petraeus was way at the front. And I was pouring coffee for Petraeus and his wife, Holly, and like handing it to him. And I was like, this guy's the current director of the CIA. There's not a single security guy around. Like, this is fucking insane. But he was cool. You know, he's a nice guy. Yeah. You know, nothing bad to say about him. It was just a little surreal interlude right there.
Yeah. So that was probably the last time I ever spoke to. No, I spoke to another. I remember speaking to a soft general. I can't remember who it was now, a couple of years later. But again, I never get anything out of those interviews. They give you a limited amount of time, and you know you've got their whole entourage mean mugging you the whole time about what you're asking, and you know they're only going to tell you what they want to tell you anyway. And these guys are all very career minded.
Yes. They're popping the Jesus pills.
I rarely speak to anyone above a captain, just because, you know, when they get to major, they start thinking about, okay, what if certain majors are like, okay, I'm topped out as a major, or I'm going to go and, you know, I'm going to go for the brass ring. And there are two different kinds of majors, and the majors I like are the ones where you're like, you know, they speak truth to power. They'll tell you all kinds of shit. But otherwise, I just don't get anything out of those guys.
I every time there's a new general elected, not elected, but appointed to be, you know, the commander of SOCOM or JSOC or whatever the hell it is, these like cringeworthy articles without fail appear in the mainstream media. Shadowy general takes new appointment. And it's like this like glowing article right. about how shadowy, like I remember one of those shadowy stories was about General Votel, who like I was Facebook friends with and he's like, there's a, his photo, he was my commander in Ranger Regiment, but anyway, there's a his like Facebook picture is like him wearing like one of those like Christmas sweaters, like him and his wife. And here's like Newsweek or something, shadowy spec ops general. Like what the hell? What do you think is shadowy about General Votel exactly? I mean, yeah, a smart guy as I understand it, but when I read these articles, I get douche chills. They write them for the CIA directors also. Yeah. Shadowy John Brennan.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, really?
If they were so shadowy, you wouldn't know their names.
Yeah.
Those are the shadowy dudes. That's what I'm saying.
Shadowy general appointed to SOCOM. Like, what the fuck am I reading? But yeah, I don't know if they're like trading those, like it's a trade for access or something like that. Like, it's like this obligation, like, you know, the same as the general staff, like these journalists just have a love for the general, you know?
Well, yeah, they're starstruck as well. You know, I think that they see that as being close to the, you know, the power teat.
Yeah.
And they want to suck on it just like everybody else does. I just never felt that way. I probably would be a lot more successful in my career if I'd been.
You would.
If I were power teat hungry.
No question. You got to get down on your knee pads.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we would be definitely remiss if we didn't ask, you know, what are you working on today? Were there any projects, any more books you're working on?
Yes, a few things I'm working on. One of the things I'm working on is this is going to sound crazy, but your listeners will appreciate this. So last year I was working with a really good photographer, a guy named Nish Nalbandian, and he and I both ride motorcycles. It comes as no surprise that people that cover conflict tend to like to ride motorcycles. So we were covering the war in Mosul, and came across this really great old Russian motorcycle called the Ural, and it has it's a bike with a sidecar. So we got it in our head that we would buy this bike, have it fixed up, and then we rode it around northern Iraq and wrote a story about it for motorcyclists. So we told the story of what was going on in Iraq at that time and in that place through the bike. It was our goal to try to figure out how to tell and present an original angle on a story that people already were tuning out.
Yeah.
So we told this story about, you know, and the way we told the story through the bike was the people we came across, like the guy who owned it, had been living under siege for all these years. The bike had bullet holes in it and the gas tank had been crushed because a mortar had hit a wall in his home and it fell on the concrete, fell on the bike. So we bought it from this guy and then we had it fixed by a mechanic who had been tasked with when ISIS was there of fixing their bikes.
An Iraqi mechanic can fix anything.
Yeah, yeah, in Mosul. So, you know, and then we had an Iraqi policeman who had actually lost an eye, who also rode bikes, help us get it out because we didn't have the right paperwork. Obviously, didn't have plates on it, so we had to go through all these checkpoints. So we had to bribe our way through that. So we told the story of what was going on, like I said, through the bike and trying to reach a different audience and tell the same story but in a new way. We got it in our heads that this is something that we want to do again and potentially turn it into a series, either for streaming or for a network. And so we're putting together a concept of trying to do it as a potential series where we'd ride in different places where we'd previously worked, Afghanistan, Iraq, et cetera, et cetera.
That's pretty cool.
People are going to dig that, man.
I think so, yeah.
So once again, I mean, we've covered a lot in the past hour plus, but a lot more is covered in the book itself, so people should pick it up. It's Blindsided by the Taliban, A Journalist's Story of War, Trauma, Love, and Loss by Carmen Gentile on Skyhorse Publishing. CarmenGentile.com is the website, at Carmen Gentile on Twitter. This has been awesome, man. I mean, I think it's an excellent story, and I think it's just a story of perseverance. The fact that you wanted to keep doing what you were doing after going through the horror and having to go through like a crazy period of recuperating from,
and
you know,
I think you even talk in the book about dealing with opiate addiction, which a lot of people are dealing with, a lot of veterans, a lot of guys who get hurt. I mean, the extremely addictive pain pills.
Yeah. Yeah. I, funny enough, in my wild youth, I had indulged in other sorts of opiates that they don't come in pill form. So when I got the Oxy to alleviate the pain I was suffering from my injury, I was like, oh, this stuff's weak. You know, but I was keenly aware of how addictive it is and what a problem it is, obviously. And how it can lead to worse things, the kind of things I used to do when I was younger, that I've since long given up. I don't even drink anymore. I'm super boring. So, yeah, it's, I hope people, give it a chance. It's not, definitely not, like I say, it's not a doom and gloom war book. I don't think it's a book even, that I would say is about war per se. It's about the difficulties that we all in life face at one point or another. Life kicks us all in the ass and has us down many different ways. And it's my way of dealing with it was often with humor. I have a very dark sense of humor and a self-deprecating sense of humor that helped me get through some of the really hard times. And I hope that maybe some people will enjoy that and get something out of it as well.
Excellent, man. Thank you so much, Carmen.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it, guys.
Yeah, we'll do it again sometime. Thank you.
Absolutely. I'd love that. All right. Cool.
Appreciate it. Yeah, let us know when that next project is out and we'll do it.
Oh, cool, man. We'll do.
Awesome.
Thanks. All right. Take care.
All right. You too.
Bye.
Dude, that was, I have to say, an excellent interview. I really appreciated talking with Carmen. And, you know, I haven't read the book in its entirety. It makes me want to because, you know, I skimmed through it and we've had it for a while, but there's just so much there. And I do think it's one of those stories he said that you could relate to, you know, whatever you've gone through in your life. And also just looking at the guy, I mean, his other eye is no longer functioning really. And I've never had to experience anything remotely like that. So it's just, sometimes you need to have those examples of like, your life is not so bad.
Yeah.
Get your shit together.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, well, we've had another dude with a pirate patch, Dan Crenshaw. He's been on the show.
Ivan Castro,
and then we had...
Ivan Castro has no eyesight. I mean, I met him in person, and Ivan Castro is completely blind.
Where is the book? We have... oh, here it is. This is a good one, too. Andy Grant. Yep. You remember him?
Yep, lost his leg.
And he had the tattoo on his leg.
It says, you'll never walk again.
No. It said, you'll never walk alone.
Alone.
Because it was a motto of the soccer team he liked.
Yep.
And then when they cut off it, they had to amputate his leg. And
it became.
And then because it cut off the end of his tattoo, it said, you'll never walk.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Which is so, I mean, the whole thing. Because I remember when we got, you know, we saw the title of the book. It's like, oh, it's an obvious title. You would never think that it's related to an actual tattoo. You would think someone just said to him, you'll never walk again.
But I mean, go back and listen to that episode. But I mean, just spoiler alert, he did walk again. I mean, he participates in like sports and stuff like that.
Yeah.
He's doing,
I think, breaking records and stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm actually glad you mentioned the opiate thing. Cause I wasn't even thinking of it. I'm always, you're probably the same way as I'm doing just things in my regular life. I'm always thinking of like how it could relate to this show. And I saw that documentary on Netflix called A Leaf of Faith about kratom. I don't know if you're familiar with the whole thing, but kratom is being used as like to treat opiate addiction. And it's not even really a drug. Technically, but you don't get high off of it. You know, it's almost like taking caffeine or something.
Okay.
But apparently it's helping people. The funny thing is I was just in Florida. I was in like the Delray Beach area, which is the rehab capital of the world. And I saw all these kava bars, which is apparently kratom in a drink, and people drink it. You see it just everywhere you go. And some people go and they say it's relaxing, but other people really are on opiates, and this is something they're using.
And that helps like wean people off of opiates?
Apparently, really? So. So in the documentary, there was a lot of coverage of different things, including veterans with PTSD who got hooked on opiates that, you know, this has helped them tremendously. There were groups covered in the documentary of like one guy who was a veteran who had anger issues and PTSD and all this stuff. and he is using Kratom to treat his addiction and helping other veterans. And I remember I forgot about it because this was before my trip to Florida. I was like, I got to get this guy on the podcast. So now I'm reminded, and I will try to get him on maybe in January or February. But yeah, combat veteran, and he's just a huge advocate for Kratom, as a lot of people are. And it's a weird thing because right now it's legal, I think, in just about all states. I've even driven by gas stations and stuff where it's like, we sell Kratom here. And there's like a few fringe lawmakers that are trying to fight Kratom and make it illegal. And there doesn't seem to be any good reason why. I mean, like, there, you guys all have to see the documentary. It's called The Leaf of Faith. But like, there's one kid who jumped off a bridge to his death, and his parents blame Kratom. But then you look further into the story, and he was on all different types of things, had a history of depression. And it seems like Kratom very likely had absolutely nothing to do with this kid killing himself. But, you know, there's always these lobbyists and even the parents on some level that they need to point to the finger at someone who or something.
Yeah,
that caused their family member to do this.
There's always these like busybody politicians, and you see them like, and sometimes like police organizations also. They're like, oh my God, there's this new drug that kids are on, and they do like a big news story on it. I was like, man, no kids ever heard of this fucking bullshit until you did this stupid news story about it.
Well, and then that's the thing. This Kratom thing gets lumped in with like bath salts and, you know, these things.
That's one of them, yeah.
But bath salts really was fucking crazy. I mean, there were people out there who were like, you know, they were like doing things to themselves. It's when you hear about LSD users cutting themselves with glass and like jumping off buildings. I think bath salts were causing that same type of reaction. There doesn't seem to be, at least from this documentary, any of that with Kratom. And I think it'd be an interesting topic. I mean, we've talked about veterans healing from PTSD with ecstasy, with MDMA.
Yeah.
Remember, we had the New York Times writer on. So I think it'd be an interesting thing to cover. And it's a Mark Bell documentary. If you guys have seen Bigger, Faster, Stronger, that's Mark Bell, or Prescription Thugs, or Trophy Kids. I've seen them all. I'm a big fan of his. He does great documentaries.
I like to watch those. What's that series on Netflix about financial crime? I can't remember the title, but it's good. Every episode is about like high finance people getting in a shitload of trouble.
Okay. Yeah. With Mark Bell, I really appreciate his honesty when he does this documentary. Like, while he did Prescription Thugs, which was about opioid addiction and all this stuff, halfway into the movie, he's like, all right, I've been telling you about all these terrible things with opioids, people buying it on Craigslist. And he's like meeting with congressmen to get it off Craigslist. And he's like, I have to tell you something. I currently am addicted to opioids, and like goes into it and how he developed that. He got into a car accident while filming the documentary, I think while high driving around. And I just appreciate the honesty of it. So yeah, I probably have a note in my phone somewhere while I was watching the movie with the guy's name where I was like, get this guy on to talk Kratom. So hopefully we will. Anyway, with what's going on at the site, I wanted to mention that Alex Hollings has a new article out titled "Cop That Hit Outside During Parkland Shooting, School Shooting Did Nothing Wrong, Federal Judge Rules." And Alex basically made the point that, yeah, legally this guy may not have done anything wrong, but morally, he definitely did something wrong, and people's kids' lives were lost because of his cowardice. You know, when you take a job like that, I think that it's understood that you're willing to jump into the fire. And there's also a new George Hand article. I know we've had a few people say, how come we haven't seen any new George Hand stuff? So there's a brand new George Hand article, The Internet Trap, Protect Thyself. And people love to see George's articles on the site. This is more digital stuff, not in his realm of human trafficking. But George writes about all different stuff. I like how I was about to drink this water with the cap on, which you can't see because
I'm trying to hydrate, too. Like I was saying beforehand, I was out drinking with my friend last night.
I mean, hey,
it's a little trashed when I got home.
That's the cool thing, though. We still got to conduct a good interview. You had your
sir.
Came in here.
Yes, sir.
Before I do the live reads, I also want to mention, I said on the episode with Nick Kaufman that we're no longer going to be doing YouTube stuff. I rethought that a little bit because we have episodes on YouTube that have reached up to 100,000 people. And I was like looking through it, like Brandon with Rob O'Neill, that's 100,000 viewers. We have stuff with like Tonto and a few other big ones that have reached, you know, like 5,000, 6,000. So it, those are numbers I wouldn't want to get rid of, basically, and just make this a dead channel. So we're no longer going to do YouTube for like every episode, but if we have a big guest who comes in here, like let's say when we had, I'm just trying to think of Jeffrey Wright, who came in with Brandon, and who's a big name actor, did this HBO documentary. That's something I think we should put on YouTube. But for the most part, we're not going to be doing so much YouTube, but I just want to keep that channel alive because there's people who use YouTube that don't really listen to podcasts. They may discover it that way.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't want to just kill the channel completely. So that's what we're doing with that. With that, be sure to check out Crate Club. We have different tiers of membership depending on how prepared you want to be, and gift options are available as well. Scott Whitner from the Loadout Room, you guys know him, and all those guys are currently working on bringing you 100% custom products in 2019. Drew Wallace as well, former Army Ranger, he's working on all that stuff. Everything from sunglass cases to EDC bags and other manly products. It's a club for men, by men. You can check that all out at crateclub.us. Once again, that's crateclub.us. Also, as a reminder for all those listening, for a limited time, you can receive a 50% discounted membership to the Spec Ops channel, our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops channel premiere show Training Cell follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country, everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. And you can watch that content by subscribing to the Spec Ops channel at specopschannel.com and take advantage of a limited time offer of 50% off your membership, only $4.99 a month. And check out the app, too, the Spec Ops Channel app. Hope that you guys all enjoy your Christmas. This is the last episode before Christmas, and especially you guys who are overseas, who are downrange, who don't get to spend your Christmas with your family, you know, we respect what you're doing, and it's got to be tough. I know you've been there once, you said, so.
Yeah, like I've said before, I was very lucky. I think I only missed one Christmas, actually, while I was in the military.
Yeah, so I'm sure a lot of you guys have missed more than that, and it's got to be, I don't know, just at the forefront of your mind. So all those spending it with your family, hope you have a great one, and those overseas, stay strong. And I have to say, this was probably like one of my favorite episodes. I really thought that was an excellent interview. I thought Carmen was great.
Yeah, no, it was really interesting. Provides a different perspective, for sure. I think might be, is that the first time we've interviewed an embedded journalist? Guy who did a combat embed?
Yeah, the only thing I could think of is, you know, Joey is a photographer, but that's different. He's done
I don't think he ever did an embed.
I'm just thinking a combat photographer. Yeah. Probably. Yeah, it probably is.
We had Sean Naylor on once, but also not an embed.
Did Ed Derrick do any?
He did a lot. He did a lot. Yeah.
So then Ed Derrick.
Okay.
Who's coming back on? He's going to be back on mid-January.
I don't think we ever... when we had him on before, we were talking about the Extortion 17 crash.
We talked a little bit about that stuff, I think.
Did we talk about his embeds?
I think we might have mentioned it at least. Guys, we're up to 400-plus episodes. I remember everyone we interview, but I can't remember every detail of every interview.
Yeah, but definitely go check out Carmen's book. It's definitely got a interesting perspective. He does have a sense of humor.
Oh yeah, you can tell.
Yeah. That was a fun interview.
Cool. All right. Well, have a great weekend and a Merry Christmas, guys.
Don't say Merry Christmas. We got to keep it secular, Ian.
And actually, we won't. Normally, I would be doing the best of for the next episode because I was like, it's Christmas Eve. It's Christmas. But luckily, Jay, as you guys know, Jay from the UK, one of our writers, who's back. He was on my ass saying, we got to do a show on Ukraine constantly. So I was like, all right, we'll do it. And so that's the next show you're going to hear. We already recorded it, but it'll be 100% new material and not a best of.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter @SoftRep Radio.